This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.
When I worked for UPI, wire service, I had to stick to the facts, and now I'm allowed to have an opinion. Now I wake up in the morning and I say to myself, who do I hate today?
That was Helen Thomas, former UPI White House correspondent, speaking at MIT's Bartos Theater. Thomas writes for Hearst News Service and is now free to express her opinion, which she gives freely.
Well, I never beat around the bush. Excuse the pun. I hate war. Besides, I've lived long enough to see so many of our reviled enemies become our friends. So maybe there is a better way instead of the killing fields. I've never covered a president before in all my years in Washington who actually wanted to go to war, first resort. Not the end of diplomacy, not the end of talk, not the end of negotiations. Others would go, of course, but in this case, it's the first resort. Iraq has been on President Bush's radar since he came into office and even before. Whenever it seems that he may be easing up, his cordon of hawk and hardline advisors rein him in. Not that he is not obsessed. Saddam Hussein is his white whale. It's more than that. He and his cohorts are pursuing a policy that is alien to all that we've ever stood for since World War II, at least in terms of collective security, containment, peaceful diplomacy, peaceful negotiations. The Bush policy of preemptive war is immoral. Historian Arthur Schlesinger, put it well. He said that such a policy would legitimize Pearl Harbor. But he has given a green light, President Bush has been given a green light from Congress. So it's once more into the breach with none of the lessons learned since Vietnam. Sure, we'll win that war, bomb the Iraqis who are left, bomb them into democracy. No other country is really with us on this. Tony Blair is apparently not speaking for the British people on this one. The Air Force has been doing practice runs in southern Iraq. And do I dare to assume that it is hoped that some Iraqi will be foolhardy enough to give Bush an excuse for the war that he longs for? Where are the peacemakers? I thought we had to retaliate in Afghanistan, but perpetual war, war without end, is hardly what anyone would want to look forward to for their children, their grandchildren. What a way to begin the 21st century, and we thought that we were going to live happily ever after when the Cold War ended. I have to admit, the Bushites have played the war card well. The economy, prescription drugs, other domestic issues have been pushed aside. Rightfully so, because clearly they have no answers. Start drilling oil in Alaska. Forget Enron and the corporate greed. Give those hungry Wall Street investors a cut in the Social Security benefits. Well, I say cry, the beloved country. We have arrived at a stage where there are no ideals, no inspiration, no hope. It's not only a swing to the right. It's a big slide away from the values and principles that have made this country so great. We have seen Americans too willing to give up their freedom for security, Big Brother style, darkness at noon, as well as Orwell. It's odd for me to quote Bob Barr, the conservative congressman, who said that the real test of freedom is not during periods of peace and prosperity, but in times of national crisis. I must say, I was surprised that some great Ivy League academic defenders of civil liberties were so willing to jump over to the other side when they felt that the country was threatened. The Attorney General had ruled that deportation cases should be closed to the public and the press. Fed up, the Detroit papers finally sued and won a ruling for to be able to cover some of these deportation hearings. And federal judge Damon Keith said, "Democracy dies behind closed doors. We are so willing to accept an unprovoked war as the United States builds up its forces in the Persian Gulf. Where is the outrage? Preemptive war is not us," I maintain. At least it wasn't us in the 20th century. But we are being led to permanent, perpetual war by a man who did not choose to serve himself when he was about to be drafted for Vietnam, and that goes for all of his hawk advisors. I don't think that's a low blow, it's a truth. It's not lost on the American people that President Bush is giving a pass to diplomatic talks to North Korea, which admits it lied and has nuclear weapons in production or wants to produce them, has a program, and we are going to bomb Iraq, which may have them someday. Does that make sense to you? Of course. Or is it the oil that Iraq possesses? Anyone want to send their sons or grandchildren to die for a grab at Iraq's oil fields? Would we tolerate an attack on our nation that way? When are the American people going to wake up? To question, to dissent, is not unpatriotic. It is patriotic to be a thinking people and not to roll over as Congress did for fear that they will not get reelected without thinking of the consequences. Colin Powell, Secretary of State, was a lonesome dove, but he likes his job, and there's no room in this administration for a devil's advocate. President Bush has had only 6 news conferences in his 2 years in office, and that is playing it safe, but not consistent with true democracy. The presidential news conference is the only forum in our society where a president can be questioned on a regular basis and held accountable. Otherwise, he can rule and is ruling now by executive order, autocratically, imperialistically. I maintain that is not us and that's not democracy. You cannot have a democracy without a free press, free to ask questions. It's indispensable in our system. Well, what a difference a day makes. What a difference a year makes. We've had to tighten security like never before. Now that we know that we are vulnerable, not protected by 2 oceans. I know I sound like the bearer of bad news. Blame the messenger. We're used to that. No question our world has been shaken, shattered, maybe. But I am confident that we shall overcome. As Franklin D. Roosevelt put it at the height of the Great Depression, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. The philosopher George Santayana said that if we do not learn from our mistakes, we are doomed to repeat them in the future. It is ours to reason why, not just to do and die. We have to wake up, speak up, play a role in the decisions that affect all mankind. It's up to us to make our public servants accountable. We in the press are the self-appointed, self-anointed watchdogs of democracy. I think we also have to protect our civil liberties. Benjamin Franklin said, "If we are willing to give up our liberty for temporary security, we are in danger of losing both." And I like what Adlai Stevenson said, "Democracy is great, not just because the majority prevails, but because it's safe to be in the minority." It's also said that the only way for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing.
As a White House correspondent, Helen Thomas has covered 7 presidents during her 50 years as a reporter. In the final hours of the 107th Congress yesterday, senators pushed through a new Homeland Security Act that creates a 170,000-employee Homeland Security Department aimed at fighting terrorism on U.S. soil. The bill was drafted in the aftermath of 9/11. Jean Butterfield is with the American Immigration Law Institute, and she's concerned the new law is taking America down a very anti-American slippery slope, particularly with regard to the immigration laws.
We have, for our entire history, been a nation of immigrants and have valued the contributions of immigrants to America and to our democracy. And much of what is being done in the name of Homeland Security, both within this new legislation and with other executive branch actions is really antithetical to some of the very fundamental values upon which I think our nation is built.
For example,
massive numbers of arrests and detentions in secret without revealing who's being arrested, where they're being held, whether they're represented by counsel. For example, closed secret hearings where evidence is presented in secret and where the public and the press and even members of Congress are barred from the hearings. Measures that give broad new powers without any congressional action or oversight to local law enforcement, saying it's sort of open season on immigrants and any cop on the beat can enforce our nation's immigration laws. Massive amounts of data being collected on immigrants and being compiled into massive databases that are used to track people's movements, to check them at ports of entry, and to, you know, put new reporting requirements on them that, you know, when they don't fulfill them for entirely innocent reasons, are filled with all kind of onerous consequences like deportation. Mm. So it's really a kind of zero tolerance policy that's been put into place that has really sent a chill through, you know, hardworking and well-meaning and honest immigrant communities.
And one might argue that in the aftermath of September 11th, the federal agents that are, for example, conducting random checkpoints and searches mm-hmm. are basically just keeping our homeland safe from terrorist attacks, and that Americans can't afford to be too careful.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's certainly a necessary discussion that we have to have as a nation about what's the proper balance of security and liberty, and, you know, what measures that may compromise liberties in some way, shape, or form are necessary. And part of that balancing is to ask the question, do these measures anyway make us more secure as a people, or are they just, you know, busy work and measures that are intended to make us think something is being done to make us safer, but really is not doing that. And I think, you know, for example, the change of address requirement that's been now enforced or is being enforced for all immigrants in the country. If you don't report your change of address within 10 days, you are not only guilty of a criminal misdemeanor, but you are deportable. Well, if we penalize and make suspect or criminalize, you know, millions of otherwise law-abiding, hardworking immigrants, and we say somehow that, you know, requiring people to report their change of address makes us safer, I think we have to step back and say, well, does it really? Are the people that we need to be concerned about, you know, the handful of people who may be here intending to do us harm, are those the people who are going to report and change their address? It's just, it's kind of nonsensical when you peel away the layers.
Now, the Border Patrol defends its actions, those of conducting random checkpoints at various border locations, by saying that we, quote, we routinely run into a lot of narcotics traffickers. Mm-hmm. Because of those checkpoints, those narcotics are kept out of our schools and our streets. We also take a lot of criminals for non-immigration offenses, and we run into children who are kidnapped. So, end quote. So basically, they're doing it for the kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, there may be some legitimate law enforcement rationale for certain locations, for certain checkpoints, but I think it raises the question of, do we want to become a nation of checkpoints? Just like some of these data collection measures require us to ask the question, do we want to become a society where Big Brother knows, you know, every purchase I make at the local Safeway or every movie I rent at the local Blockbuster? And
Or every book at the local library.
Every book at the local library. I mean, the Patriot Act contained provisions requiring librarians to cooperate with the FBI when the FBI came and requested records, and which prohibited librarians from notifying the person in question that their records were being requested by the FBI. And a random survey recently by University of Illinois says that, you know, 85 of the 1,000 libraries questioned had already received that kind of request for data from the FBI. So we're on that slippery slope. We're not really engaging the questions, and we're not really taking a hard look at what's at stake here, I think.
So this Homeland Security Act is not just targeted at the civil liberties and the rights of immigrants to this country.
Right. It's targeted at, you know, all of us, and I think it needs to be examined and looked at by all of us, analyzed by all of us. I mean, we're really, you know, embarking on a process here of having our government create the largest new cabinet-level department reorganization in our nation's history. We're taking an immigration and naturalization function, which at least, you know, half of which is about services and providing services and timely adjudications to immigrants, and we're saying, oh, nope, this is first and foremost a matter of security, and we're lumping it all into a great big bureaucracy that, you know, is purportedly about defending the homeland, whatever that means.
You spoke earlier about secret hearings and massive arrests. Mm-hmm. Do you have figures on those arrests, and what kind of secret hearings?
Interestingly, you know, our Department of Justice has refused to release data or numbers or information, but from piecing together certain information and from certain reporting that the Justice Department has been required to do in the context of some court challenges to its practices, we know that at least 1,200, and some say more, in the vicinity of 2,000, mostly Arab, mostly Muslim men were arrested in the weeks and months after 9/11, and were detained. And we also know from reporting from lawyers involved and from the actual detainees themselves at certain points, excuse me, that the vast majority of these, all of them so far as we know so far, have been only charged with technical immigration violations. They weren't terrorists. They had nothing to do with a terrorist enterprise. They were people who had perhaps worked without authorization, overstayed a visitor visa, been a student studying here and hadn't taken the full complement of course load that put them out of status, and they were all charged with deportation based on these technical violations. But all of these proceedings were conducted under the highest level security in secret. People were transferred from one jail to the other in the middle of the night without notice to their family members, to their lawyers.
Disappeared, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly, for weeks at a time. Weeks at a time. And were denied access to counsel in that they were not given access to a telephone to call anybody. Finally, I think most of them were allowed one phone call per week. If they wanted to call their family member, they couldn't call their lawyer that week. I mean, it just, you know, it made a mockery of what I think we mostly understand as due process protections and the kind of principle that one is innocent until one is proven guilty.
I'm assuming we'll see some legal responses, onslaught.
There have been several court cases challenging the secrecy, challenging the closed hearings, challenging the Justice Department's refusal to release the names. But I have to say, in the climate that's being created, the political climate being created by the administration, and one in which we are all made to feel fear, we are all told that this is a war situation, these are wartime measures, the courts are apt to give a lot of deference to that sort of mantra of national security. And, you know, whether we prevail in the courts, I think, remains to be seen.
Jean Butterfield is with the American Immigration Law Institute. Political folk musician Robert Hoyt is a popular voice at protests and peace rallies across the country. His three albums, Mind's Eye, As American as You, and Dumpster Diving Across America, are rich with political messages and social commentary. When we spoke with him earlier today, he said that a people of all political persuasions are expressing concern about the impending war, even in what he calls Dan Quayle country.
I currently live in southern Indiana. I'm originally from Georgia. I've been in southern Indiana for about 5.5 years now, where the Midwest and the South and Appalachia kind of meet. It has a mixture of all those elements there.
Any signs of a peace movement going on in Indiana and Appalachia?
In the major cities, you know, like Indianapolis and Bloomington, of course, there's definitely there've been some peace actions there. But what's interesting is we've actually had some things in our own little community of Paoli. Christians and the hippies have kind of come together, and I think that's a sign of just how big this movement is when actually you have rural communities doing peace actions. In our particular community, we had a concert benefit for the children of Iraq, and the biggest purpose of that was not just to have the benefit itself, which we actually, you know, raised a lot of money. It was a big success. The press and everything for this event got the word out there that there was another way to look at this at this war. You know, this area is like very patriotic, very conservative, but they weren't getting any other message from it, certainly not from the mainstream press or anyone else, that there was another way of looking at this war. And this was kind of a way for us to kind of get in through the back door of the conscious that there were a lot of people who did not feel that, like, that this war was a good idea. And since that benefit, we've been once a week on Sunday afternoons doing a vigil County Courthouse Square, sometimes holding signs, sometimes just doing a candlelight vigil.
Mm-hmm. How many people attended the concert?
Oh, probably 100 or two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you raise a lot of money?
About $750.
Okay.
Which for a small place like that, it's pretty decent.
Mm-hmm.
We were kind of surprised. And we had, there were actually some Iraqi nationals and first-generation Iraqis, mostly from Bloomington, who came down and spoke, and that was really nice. And it was a really multicultural kind of thing. We had prayers, and Christian prayers, and Jewish prayers, and Muslim prayers.
You define yourself as a troubadour, singer-songwriter. If you had to write a song about this impending war, what might some of the lyrics say?
The title of my song is Freedom. This is an idea I got from John Trudell, his talks I heard recorded. That's Freedom, F-R-E-E-D-U-M-B.
I had a feeling you were going to go there.
do you want to hear the whole thing?
Yes.
So, Mr. President, you were down on your luck. You were slipping in the polls when the enemy struck. But that enemy is not so bad. In fact, he's the best friend that you ever had. And the chorus goes, Freedom, D-U-M-B. Freedom, watching your TV. Freedom may be free for some, but you're not free. You're just dumb.
If you write that song, there's a chance that people may not come up to you again and accuse you of being a good American, as you've been accused of in the past.
Well, you know, I just have to write what I feel and what I see. And what I say about this song easily is that if you think I'm writing about you in that song, then I probably am.
You did write a song called A Good American.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened? What inspired you to write that song?
I wrote that song back in 1990. It's kind of interesting. I went out for the first Redwood Summer, and back in 1990, it was the campaign for people all over the country to help stop the logging of the last old-growth redwoods in Northern California. And a friend I met out there, as we were parting, he gave me a hug, and he said, Robert, you're a good American. And I had to stop and think about that for a minute. I'm like, well, gee, I guess there could be such a thing. And that's what inspired the song. It was kind of interesting at that time. It was like the next day was when Saddam Hussein marched into Kuwait and all that stuff began. So when I came home, all this was happening and going through my mind, and knowing how in that particular movement, through the environmental movement there and around the country, how the FBI had been infiltrating and doing their same dirty tricks they like did to AIM and the Black Panthers and such.
All right. Well, any final thoughts on your part?
Muse is a good tool for inspiring and empowering, motivating and helping to heal, you know, the wounded activist spirit. And it's just too bad that more of that kind of music doesn't get a chance to be played either in the concert venues or on the radio stations. And appreciate Pacifica that they're putting this out for us.
Is your activist spirit feeling wounded these days?
It's always felt wounded, but I tell you what, with this war coming on, it's actually been kind of an inspiration. It's actually kind of jump-started me and got me going again.
All you good Americans that read between the lines, help your siblings everywhere to open up closed minds. Stand up to those who are to blame for crimes committed in our name. All you good Americans, things can't stay the same. All you good Americans, be wise to their ways. Time has come to raise your fist and say enough's enough. They'll put your name on their list and they might get rough. But that list gets longer every day and they can't scare us away. All you good Americans, rejoice, it's on a
from the heartland of the U.S., troubadour Robert Hoyt. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Mona Elias of Pacifica Station WPFW. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA, Laurel Padgett-Seekins, and Tom Gomez. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.